Chapter 17. 4 weeks into our idyllic tropical vacation on Newark, I got a call. "Colonel," came the voice of Sergeant Adams in my Z-phone earpiece. "There's something you need to see over here."
"Trouble?"
I brushed off my hands, as I'd been helping dig to enlarge one of the back caverns of the lower cave. The rock here was crumbly. That scared me about the cavern's integrity, but a couple feet down we hit a solid rock like granite. If we could clear out all the crumbly rock, we have a lot more space. Sims had offered to move some of our stack of supplies out of the main cavern if we could find a safe, dry place.
"Not exactly," she replied. "Not at the moment."
"Where are you?"
I was intrigued.
"The cathedral complex, sir."
She meant a large cavern that, to some people, looked like a cathedral. It had a large entrance flanked by tall, column-like stones. The entrance had once been much smaller until the roof collapsed under the crushing weight of snow and ice eons ago, or so our science team speculated. We had looked into the cathedral complex as a possible habitat, but the entrance chamber afforded us little cover, and large, solid stones blocked the way into caves further under the hills. I'd given permission for people to recon the place in case we could make something of it. The cathedral was conveniently located less than 2 kilometers up the canyon. Still, it was a long walk in heavy gravity and low oxygen, and it would be getting dark soon.
"You can't give me a hint, Adams?"
"You'd really better see this for yourself, sir. It's important."
Adams knew that because of our history, she could push me further than other people could. As a colonel, I could have ordered her to tell me what was going on. I didn't. I trusted her judgment instead. Going to the cathedral with darkness approaching meant walking up the canyon floor, sometimes splashing knee-deep through the ice-melt stream that meandered from one side of the canyon to another. That afternoon, for the first time in 3 days, it wasn't raining. It was cloudy, bleak, chilly, with a stiff wind blowing straight into my face down the canyon. Looking in front, then behind me, there wasn't another human in sight. Everyone was safely tucked into our caverns except for the team excavating the cathedral complex. I paused to zip up my jacket against the wind and stared down into the stream. There were tiny animals in the water. I'd seen them in the science team's microscopes. They were hardy creatures, and I felt sorry for them. If the science team was right, and I'd seen their evidence with my own eyes, Newark had once had abundant life. There had at least been flying insects or something similar, whatever had spread pollen from flower to flower. Then the planet had somehow become locked in an ice age. It was now a frozen, chilly, icy, rainy, thoroughly miserable place. But once it had been a decent place for life, at least around the equator. Likely I would never see Newark again after we left, and I couldn't imagine another species was choosing the planet for a colony. A gust of wind shook me out of my daydream. I tried to step on rocks to cross the stream, but the rocks were slippery, and I skidded off into the cold water up to my knees. Crap! Whatever reason Adams wanted me at the cathedral, it had better be damned good. Adams was waiting for me at the entrance with a big flashlight. Even with Skippy controlling the satellite images, we didn't like to use artificial light in the open. It was too risky. Whatever she wanted me to see, it didn't have her scared. The expression on her face was, I thought, excited. And sad. A deep sadness. "What's the big secret, Adams?" She turned and walked toward the back of the cathedral, toward the large, flat stone we called the altar.
"You'll see, sir."
We had to clamber over stones and squeeze around a large boulder that had once been part of the ceiling. I had never been this far back into the cavern before. The science team, with a lot of help from soldiers who were bored and had nothing else to do, had excavated a huge pile of stones that had blocked the way into what we thought might be a much larger chamber. There was not yet any large cavern. There was a path that had been made to get by the big boulder. Then we had to walk steeply up through a long, low-ceiling passage and into a tall, narrow chamber. As I crouched down in the passage, nearly scraping my head on the ceiling, I grumbled, "Adams, if this is a surprise party for my birthday or something, there had better be a big goddamn cake." There was no cake. There was a well-lit chamber, square, roughly 10 meters on a side, and it was tall, perhaps 6 meters. It was square. Square, like, almost precisely. In some areas there were indentations in the walls that had once been filled with some sort of brick and plaster. The plaster had weakened over time, and some bricks had tumbled onto the floor.
On the floor there was a stacked pile of bricks and another stack of carved stones. Carved. Artificial. None of what I saw could have been natural. I gasped and looked up at Adams. She nodded.
I know, sir. I couldn't believe it either when I saw it. Dr. Graziano found it this morning.
And you waited until now to tell me?
Graziano explained.
We wanted to be certain that these stones don't merely give the appearance of having been carved. These stones are old, Colonel, old. They would have flaked off and looked like much of nothing if this chamber hadn't kept them dry all this time.
All what time? How long ago? If there were other sentient beings on Newark, I wanted to know immediately.
He shrugged.
I don't know. Not yet. I'll need Mr. Skippy to assist with the analysis. Very old. Hundreds of thousands of years at the very least. Probably more.
He ran a hand lightly along one carved edge.
Whoever made this, they are long gone from here.
Huh, I said, glancing around the rock chamber. The years had eroded it somewhat. Still, I could see the stone walls had been shaped, smoothed, by someone's hand long ago.
So, what, you think some aliens took shelter here? They got stuck on Newark and created this place to take shelter while they waited for rescue?
Enlarging a chamber is something that I could see a stranded starship crew doing, especially if they didn't have power cells for heat like we did. Why they would carve stones into blocks made little sense. Why would they need to build a wall? Were they Cristang?
Graziano glanced at Adams and she gave a little shrug.
He doesn't know, she said to the scientist. I thought he should see for himself.
We found it only a few hours ago, Graziano explained to me.
Come this way, please, Colonel Bishop.
He pointed to an opening in the far wall that was so low he needed to get on hands and knees and crawl. The opening had at one time been blocked up by stones, which Graziano and his team had carefully removed. I followed on hands and knees, with Adams behind me. Graziano and Adams had lights. I should have brought one along. That was stupid of me. It was growing dark outside anyway. The passageway we had to crawl through was only 20 feet long. It soon opened up into another chamber, this one far larger. This chamber had also been worked on by sentient beings. The walls were smooth and straight. That wasn't all. There were bones. Bones and tools. Bronze tools. Axes. Shovels. Spears. Swords. Arrowheads. The tools were mostly upright in ceramic containers, with a few scattered on the floor where their ceramic containers had broken. None of the bones were scattered. They were all carefully laid on carved stone slabs. The bodies may have been dressed in fine clothing or wrapped in ceremonial cloth, but now they were only bones. Some had bronze shields laid atop them, some without. I knelt down to examine one set of bones. Bipedal, like us. Two arms, two legs, a head with holes for two eyes, and an opening for a nose that was more horizontal than humans. The leg bones were heavy, and they were short, shorter than the average human. Shorter than humans used to be in ages past? I didn't know. The carvings on the slabs were eroded, their edges rounded. I reached out to touch a carving when Graziano coughed. Sorry, I said guiltily, looking at the gloves he was wearing. I wanted to see if these carvings show what they looked like.
They do.
He pointed at one slab where Drs. Venkman and Friedlander were painstakingly clearing off accumulated dust with soft brushes. Graziano led me over to a shield which had been removed from the body it covered. The shield had been partly cleared of corrosion, exposing an area which depicted a figure in highly realistic detail. The figure stood on two legs. It carried a sword in one hand and some type of plant or branches in the other. It was overall more squat and bulky than a modern human, and what I thought at first was a helmet was, after close inspection, a bony ridge on top of its head. I glanced between the bones on the stone slab to the depiction on the shield. The bones also had a bony ridge.
They were shorter than us, I remarked without thinking.
The higher gravity, Graziano noted. Thicker bones also.
This was not a starship crew, I said almost to myself, considering the bronze tools. Surely any species advanced enough to make starships would have tools of steel rather than bronze.
Or they would have tools constructed of composites or exotic materials, not bronze. Almost I said creatures. These were not mere creatures. They created tools be working metal. These were people. These people were natives here. How is that possible on this frozen planet?
Yes, Venkman said, standing up to brush the dust off her pants. These were natives. Remember what I showed you about the plants that used to have flowers? Newark used to be warmer, significantly warmer. These people, as you say, are more evidence to support that conclusion.
And then what? I asked, peering intently at the figure on the bronze shield. The planet went into an ice age and they all died? Everything? Not only them. All planets and animals on land went extinct?
We don't understand how.
Friedlander joined the conversation. He was a rocket scientist on loan to UNEF from NASA.
We may never know the mechanism, not unless we stay here and study this planet much longer than we plan to.
They all died? I couldn't process that. An entire species, an entire civilization gone, completely wiped out. Because of an ice age?
Yes, Venkman replied. This is not unprecedented. There is genetic evidence that the total human population shrank to as few as 5 or 10,000 people around 70,000 years ago.
The Toba catastrophe, Graziano started to say.
That is only one theory, Friedlander interjected, and there is contradictory evidence.
Toba? I asked, wondering if T-O-B-A was an acronym for something.
Toba was a supervolcano in Indonesia. It erupted around 70,000 years ago, Venkman explained, and left a thick layer of ash around the planet. There is a theory that the Toba event caused a global winter, and that event roughly coincides with a bottleneck in human genetic diversity. The point, Colonel, is that we came close to humanity going extinct, perhaps several times. With the severe changes to temperatures on Newark, it is not surprising that a relatively advanced civilization would not have been able to adapt quickly enough to survive. Imagine if ice had advanced down from the poles to the equator on Earth during the time of ancient Egypt or Sumeria. Would those people have been able to survive?
She shook her head. They all died, I said quietly, and no one responded. They all knew I wasn't asking a question.
We are near the equator here. They came here as the temperature dropped.
To what? Try to survive in caves?
Why wouldn't they have chosen the caverns we are living in now?
The cathedral is too open, I pointed out. That's why we weren't living in it.
Graziano spoke first. We think, Colonel, that what we call the cathedral used to extend forward much further. We believe the canyon outside did not exist back then. It was probably an ordinary stream on the surface in that time. Over the years, glaciers advanced, retreated again over and over, and the ice and seasonal melt flooding carved the canyon. The roof of the cathedral was underground back then, and with hot springs around, these caverns would have been one of the last places the natives, he pointed to the dry bones, could have survived the deep freeze. They held out here, the last of their kind, until the food ran out or diseases took them. With the population clustered tightly together here, pathogens could have spread widely, especially with these people stressed from severe cold and poor nutrition.
The weight of the glacier collapsed the roof of the cavern? I didn't like hearing that. If one roof could collapse, then the roofs of our two caverns could be unstable, weakened by past glaciers.
That is possible, yes. It is more likely that seasonal flooding of the stream slowly wore away material above the cavern, exposing the stones that formed the roof. It would have been weakened. Water gets in, freezes, causes cracks. The cracks widen, more water seeps in. It is a slow process. Over the course of 100,000 years, perhaps 1,000,000 years, water is unstoppable.
Millions? I asked, surprised.
As of now, we don't know, Graziano admitted. This chamber was sealed until we broke in. The stones were set very closely together, using almost no mortar to fill the gaps. Moisture and oxygen were kept out, and this chamber is above the cathedral. It is protected from flooding. We see marks of flooding on the walls of the cathedral chamber. The flood marks reach only one-third of the way up that low-ceilinged passageway you climbed.
I looked around the chamber. They didn't live in here. This was a tomb. They left the bodies and sealed it behind them.
We think so, yes, Venkman said. It may have been one of the last things they did. Perhaps the very last thing. I would not be surprised to find more bones and more tools beneath the floor of the cathedral. The items here and in the chamber before this one were preserved because moisture and oxygen were kept out after the chambers were sealed.
I can't imagine this, I said with complete candor. A civilization, an entire species, moving steadily toward the equator as the cold crept down from the poles until they reached the furthest point they could go, and it too began to freeze.
No one can, Friedlander said quietly.
News of the discoveries at the cathedral complex spread like wildfire among our small population, and with news inevitably came rumors. By the following morning, so many people wanted to visit the cathedral complex that I knew I had to do something about it. Graziano, who had slept at the cathedral overnight, had come back to the main cavern for more supplies that morning, so I found him talking with Major Sims.
Dr. Graziano, I said, could you put together a briefing of what we think we know at the moment? There are a lot of rumors flying around. There's no reason for disinformation.
Sims snorted when I said that. I knew what she was thinking.
Sorry, Major, I offered. There was a time when disinformation was necessary on Paradise. I couldn't tell the truth about Skippy without revealing it to the people who were staying behind, and we couldn't risk them telling the Ruha or Kristang or whoever is in control of Paradise at the time. Besides, I gave a grin that I hoped would lighten the mood.
That was a damned inspiring speech I made, right?
Sims snorted.
It wasn't your speech, sir. Frankly, given your... what little I know of your reputation, she glanced at me to gauge my reaction, I was afraid the Special Forces mission you claim to be running would be some slapdash operation thrown together at the last minute.
Like going after an invading force with an ice cream truck?
Yes, sir. I didn't know much about you before you fell out of the sky onto my base in a stolen Ruha spaceship. All I knew was you did some rash thing on Earth and got lucky, then you got promoted as a publicity stunt for the Ruha.
Sorry, sir, that's what most people were thinking at the time.
No apology needed, Major. I knew it was a publicity stunt.
I was afraid UNEF would have me going around giving speeches to sell war bonds or something before they assigned me to plant potatoes.
Sims nodded.
That dodo you flew in, that was more convincing than any speech. Being able to steal and fly an alien aircraft was impressive.
Oh, and when you came out of the dodo, stunned those Ruha, and they weren't able to shoot back?
I saw that happen. One of those Ruha was totally shocked that his rifle didn't work. That and the message from UNEF HQ that I now know Skippy faked, and her mouth turned down at the thought of being manipulated.
Sorry about that. It was necessary.
If it wasn't my speech, what convinced you to come with us?
Those faked orders from UNEF HQ, and you caught us at the right moment. You said you were going to hit the Kristang, not the Ruha. We'd all heard rumors about what was going on back on Earth. I'd seen fortune cookies myself. We got them regularly enough when we opened boxes at the warehouse. You were the first UNEF soldier who told us what we all wanted to hear, that we were taking action against the Kristang. We also, especially us in the Supply Corps, figured we didn't have much to lose.
How's that? I couldn't understand what she meant by that last remark.
We knew better than anyone else how thin our food stocks were getting back then, Sims explained. You sent Chang and Adams to the warehouse to check on supplies, and they came back to the dodo saying supplies were adequate, right?
That was a while ago. I had to pause to think back that far. Sure.
What they didn't know is the warehouse was a lot more empty than it looked. My aide and I would go into the warehouse late at night with a wheelbarrow of rocks. We used the rocks to fill food boxes that we pushed to the back of the shelves. Then we'd fudge the inventory records, so even my people didn't know how thin our supplies were. I gave orders that we weren't to issue the last two boxes of anything without my direct approval, so people didn't unknowingly issue a box of rocks to the field. When we loaded up the dodo, I made sure we got only real food containers, not rocks.
That surprised me. Major, I knew our food stocks were running low.
I had no idea.
HQ knew, she said. They were closing regional logistics centers, supposedly to consolidate operations as we cleared hamsters by sector. The real reason is that HQ didn't want people to see empty warehouses.
You take what little supplies are left, concentrate the supplies in a few logistics bases, and when people see those bases have plenty of supplies, they think we're good. They didn't see the overall situation. My base was scheduled to shut down in 2 weeks before the Ruhar took the planet back. I was sweating that by the end of 2 weeks I figured all we'd have left is boxes of rocks. My CO knew about me faking inventory records. I got the idea from an intel officer with UNFHQ.
Intel, I said sourly. Yeah, I know the type.
As the words came out of my mouth, I realized that, however I'd felt screwed by my experience with intel operations, I'd done worse. Much worse. I had deceived people, concealed the truth, revealed only those parts of the truth I felt was convenient at the time. All for a good cause, of course. If I hadn't deceived people, we would never have gotten enough volunteers to capture a Kristang starship, a Theranin star carrier, and to raid an asteroid base to get an Elder controller device to shut down the wormhole that gave the enemy access to Earth. With me initially lying to people, Earth would still be under the cruel control of the Kristang. It had all been worth it. I would do it again without regret. Well, that didn't make me feel any better about having done it. Maybe all people who worked in Intel feel that way. Until they get used to it.
Sir, William spoke up to defend me. However you did it, we on Earth are very grateful. Things were getting desperate. It was bad enough what the lizards were doing on Earth. It was almost worse that we had no communication with the X-4. We knew you had landed on Perdassus. You called it Paradise. That's all the Kristang told us.
Sims and I shared a knowing look. We didn't hear anything from Earth, she said sadly. Until we got our first fortune cookie. You know about the fortune cookies? She asked the question to Williams.
Not until I read your debriefing, Williams said. That must have been a closely held secret on Earth.
And then the fortune cookie stopped, Sim said, because the Kristang stopped bringing supplies from Earth.
Yes, Williams added. We knew things were going south for the X-4 when the Kristang shut down the space elevator in Ecuador. The thinking on Earth was the only reason to do that was they didn't need to ship a lot of supplies off-world anymore. There were rumors going around that the entire expeditionary force had been wiped out. We knew the Kristang on Earth were pissed about something. I guess that must have been the Ruhar raid when your team shot down those two dropships, the whales.
Could be, I nodded.
My parents told me that they thought I was dead. It surprised the hell out of them when I called. What was your cover story? Williams asked. You didn't tell them the truth, did you?
It surprised me that Williams didn't know the cover story that UNEF had cooked up until I remembered that he, and most of the Spec Ops people, had been selected less than 2 weeks before the Dutchman departed, and those 2 weeks had been frantic 18-hour days for everyone involved. Although the entire original merry band of pirates had all been given the cover story, UNEF hadn't planned to release it to the public until after the Flying Dutchman left Earth orbit.
The cover story? Your team wasn't read in before we left? There wasn't time, sir. UNEF wanted us aboard the Dutchman as soon as possible after we were selected. I think part of that was operational security. We couldn't talk to people on Earth if we were already in orbit.
That made sense to me. I remembered that UNEF had insisted all communications to and from the Dutchman went through UNEF HQ in Paris. Skippy, naturally, had ignored silly monkey regulations. As the commander, I had done my best to comply with the rules, whether I liked it or not.
UNEF's cover story, it should have been released to the public on Earth by now, is that the merry band of pirates, you know, the original crew, came back to Earth aboard a Theranin ship because the Theranin were upset that the Kristang on Earth were acting without authority. The public thinks we were passengers on the ship, flown by Theranin, and the Theranin killed the Kristang on Earth because those lizards were ransacking the planet of an ally. Governments thought it would be too much for the public to take if they learned that both the Ruhar and the Kristang are our enemies, that the entire galaxy is hostile to humans, hostile with an overwhelming technological advantage. For myself, I'm not sure the Ruhar are our enemies. They seem more likely to ignore us than bother conquering us. I also don't know that the Ruhar would go out of their way to help us. They have enough on their plate. When I was on Paradise, after the Ruhar took the place back, the deputy administrator told me they had plans to sustain UNEF for a time until humans could grow enough food for themselves. That's all great. It all depends on what happens with the Ruhar's wider military campaign. Really, it depends on how the Giraptha fare against the Theranin.
If the Giraptha suffer a major defeat, the Ruha won't have the resources to spare for a low-tech species like humans. UNEF has a lot of mouths to feed on Paradise, and I'm sure most of the Ruha there don't feel like they owe humans anything.
Do you trust the Ruha? Sims asked. You had more contact with them than I did.
I told her about the intel the Burgermeister gave to me. Intel that I had trusted. Intel Skippy later told me was 100% accurate. I trust that the Burgermeister, the deputy administrator, was sincere about what she told me, I said honestly. I don't trust whether she will be able to deliver. It's not only up to her. I turned my attention back to Graziano. Doctor?
Yes, I will create a summary of what we know to date. It is not much, he said, almost as an apology.
We all understand that, Doctor. Do the best you can, and whatever resources you need to learn more about the people who lived here, you will have it.
Graziano asked for more people and more equipment to assist in excavating the cathedral complex. There was no need for me to request volunteers. Everyone wanted to help.
Graziano's problem was not lack of help, it was restraining the volunteers' enthusiasm for moving rocks and digging soil. Skippy volunteered also. He assigned a submine to research what he could about Newark, attempting to figure how a civilization could have arisen on such a frozen planet, and what caused them to become extinct. He called me while I was helping Dr. Zheng collect samples from a pond 300 kilometers from our home canyon.
Joe, after you found those bones, the tools, and the ruins, I took a look at Newark, and I discovered that something is very wrong with this star system.
Wrong? Beyond it being a crappy place to live?
Very much so. Disturbingly so. I wasn't paying attention before because I'm busy enough repairing the Dutchman and passively scanning for enemy starships, so I didn't bother to investigate this star system beyond the basics. It didn't matter before. Now it does. Very much. There is no way a complex species, an entire civilization, could have evolved on Newark the way the planet is now. There are currently no land animals at all above the microscopic level. Clearly, the planet's climate has changed radically. The star's output has not varied significantly within the last several million years. That cannot be the reason for the climate changing so radically. Since you found those perplexing ruins, I ran back a mathematical model of the orbits of all seven planets, and the math tells me that something disrupted their orbits about 2.7 million years ago.
Wow. I read something like that in a book once.
Incredible.
I think it was a star. I tried to remember the details of that book. I read this book a long time ago. This rogue star passed close to the star system in the book, and its gravity screwed up the orbits of all the planets.
Astonishing.
The people in the book had to leave their planet and go live on a planet they figured would end up orbiting this new star after it left their star system. Their original planet was going to be ejected away from its star or become uninhabitable or something. The writer's name was McDermott. McDevitt, something like that.
Amazing. Absolutely unbelievable.
I paused. I'm surprised you haven't heard of this before, Skippy. It must happen sometimes in the galaxy.
I remember now. The star was a brown dwarf. That's a star so small.
I know what a brown dwarf is, Joe, and yes, wandering stars occasionally do disrupt the orbits of planets and star systems they approach. That's not what I find astonishing.
Now he had me intrigued.
Then what is?
You read a book.
He laughed.
Damn it, I should have remembered what an asshole he is.
Yes, Skippy, I did.
This was a comic book, I assume. Lots of pictures.
It wasn't.
Oh, sorry, I should have said graphic novel. I don't want to upset the nerds.
It was a real book, Skippy, and I've read more than one book.
Wow, so both of these books you read. Did you have to go real slow, sound out the words as your finger slid along the page?
Forget I mentioned it, please. Under my breath, I added, asshole.
I heard that.
Can we go back to what you found about the orbits of planets in this system? Was it a brown dwarf that caused it?
No, it wasn't a wandering star or planet of any type. That would merely be interesting. The truth is, as I said, disturbing, perplexing, frightening. Look at your iPad, I'll show you.
The iPad popped up a diagram of the star system, not to scale, I assumed, with eight planets all circling the star.
Circling, not oval-shaped loops.
Newark was highlighted in blue, the gas giant in red.
Skippy, why are there 8 planets in this diagram? And I thought Newark was the 2nd one from the star. The diagram listed Newark as the 3rd planet. I used my fingertips to zoom in the display to adjust the inner planets to confirm. Newark was shown as the 3rd planet. The new 8th planet was close to the star, like Mercury. There was no such planet in the original diagram Skippy had put on the main bridge display back when he explained why he set course for this system. This, Skippy explained, is the star system 2.7 million years ago. Newark's orbit was nice and circular. It was slightly further outward from the center of this star's Goldilocks zone than Earth is from its own habitable zone, so Newark would have been slightly cooler overall. I would need ice cores to confirm. Still, I am very confident in my analysis. For many millions of years, Newark was reasonably similar to Earth in terms of habitability, which explains how complex life forms could have arisen there. Complex life forms such as the sentient beings who built the ruins you found. Sentient beings, all dead. An entire species. What happened to this place? The iPad display began to move, planets circling in their serene orbits. Then, Newark, suddenly, by itself, moved outward. Its orbit was still a circle. It was a bigger circle, further from the star. Joe, something pushed Newark out of its original orbit. The new orbit was beyond the outer edge of the habitable zone. The planet began to rapidly freeze, more rapidly than the low-tech species here could compensate for. They froze and became extinct, probably within less than 1 year. All of them. Holy shit. Oh my God. There was nothing holy about what happened here, Joe, Skippy said with surprising vehemence. I agree. The new orbit. It was still a circle? Why is it an ellipse now? The speed of the display increased, and the orbits of the planets began to wobble, disturbed from the graceful tracks they had followed for 1 billion years. Changing the orbit of Newark affected the gas giant planet I am now orbiting. That had a cascading effect on the entire system. The 2 gas giant planets in this system had a roughly 2-to-1 resonance, like Jupiter and Saturn in your home star system. Jupiter orbits twice for every 1 time Saturn circles your sun. When that resonance here was disrupted, the orbits of the other planets were disturbed. The orbit of Newark, and what is now the 1st planet, became elliptical. What was the original innermost planet, I speculate it was a small, rocky body like Mercury, had its orbit made so elliptical that it fell into the star. That is why there are now only 7 planets. Newark will eventually re-establish a circular orbit, slightly closer to the star than its original track. I predict that will happen within the next 20 million years. The ice will melt, and Newark will become a pleasant place to live. Again. A smart-ass remark popped into my head about this being a good time to buy cheap real estate on Newark. I squashed it silently. An entire sentient species had died here. Died horribly. Their entire civilization buried under a smothering blanket of snow and ice. There was nothing amusing about what had happened. How? What you showed me was Newark moving on its own. That can't happen, right? No, it can't. And given the native species' primitive level of technology, it isn't anything they did by accident or otherwise, Joe. His voice dropped to a near whisper. Pushing a planet like this took elder-level technology. Wow. Wow. I pondered that a minute. You think the Rindaloo got hold of some elder devices and used it here? Not a chance, Skippy said. The Rindaloo hadn't even discovered fire 2.7 million years ago. It couldn't be them. The elders transcended long before that, and they wouldn't have done something horrible like this. Joe, this scares the hell out of me. I have gaps in my memories that are annoying. This goes beyond annoying. Something significant happened in the galaxy that I can't account for at all. This cannot be possible, yet I cannot deny the facts. Is there any chance your analysis is wrong? There was an uncomfortable moment of silence. Joe, I'm not sure of anything right now. Based on the data, my analysis is correct. However, I could be misinterpreting the data, or I could be missing something, or my analytical functions could be faulty in ways that I cannot detect. You know that I suspect something unknown is wrong with me. Skippy, I'm sure you're doing everything you can. It's not enough.
He actually sounded sad. Almost lost.
Skip, I said. Hey, getting real here. I'm a dumb monkey. The best I can do is to be the best dumb monkey I can be. You're an AI with intelligence and knowledge I can't even imagine. No matter how smart you are, you can only do the best you can. You rescued my entire species without even stretching your abilities. No matter how incredible you are, you can only do the best you can. Whatever is wrong with your memories, it's not your fault.
Thank you, Joe. Your words would be more comforting if they weren't being spoken by a flea-infested monkey.
Damn it. Common courtesy wasn't in Skippy's nature.
This something you suspect is wrong with you. Is that why you're such an asshole?
Huh?
No, that's me. No hope of fixing that, then. I wouldn't count on it, no, he said. I appreciated his honesty.
Hey, well, maybe when you contact the collective, they will have answers for us, right?
That's what you want. Answers.
Answers like why I was buried in the ground on Paradise and how I got here. Answers like how Elder-level technology was used during a time when no intelligent being inhabited this galaxy. Answers like how Elder technology was used for unquestionably evil purposes.
Yeah. I want answers like that.